From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll tell you about the financial issues the Housing Authority of the City of Milwaukee is facing and what's being done to address them. Then environmental reporter Susan Bentz joins us to share a preview of her upcoming series, Thin Ice 2025, Our Warming Winters.
I did do a little traveling. It was really great to meet with people who are involved in projects and really want to make a difference and are tuned into this climate that is changing.
We'll speak with the new executive director of Milwaukee Film.
Well, I think nonprofits need to be a little bit scrappy. And certainly independent filmmaking is all about being scrappy. So I do think that there are some instincts there that will help me in this role.
Plus, we'll hear a mixtape of love songs picked by WUWM staff. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The Housing Authority of the City of Milwaukee, sometimes referred to as HACM, provides affordable housing options to over 10,000 families. For years, public housing residents criticized the agency's management. They've filed thousands of complaints about public safety, unsanitary living conditions, maintenance issues, and more. Last week, HACM sent a letter to residents announcing a staff reduction to avoid filing for bankruptcy and apologizing for the agency's misuse of federal funds. An investigation found HACM illegally spent $2.8 million in federal funds to pay staff. The agency's former leader, Willie Hines, recently retired, and former deputy director and chief financial officer, Fernando Aniban, also resigned. Now, under new leadership and with newly appointed board members, HACM hopes to turn things around. Former Housing Authority resident Charlotte Hazlett recently became chair of the board. She joins WUWM's Eddie Morales to talk about the agency's next steps.
With my unique experience of being a former resident, a former employee of HACM, as well as now being on the commission, I thought that, you know, it came full circle for me. I have a very strong HR background, and I've seen the embattlement that HACM was facing. And so I couldn't stand by because my heart is with the residents. I just couldn't idly stand by because, you know, with me being a resident, I am closely associated with how that feels. You know, the feeling of being marginalized or not being heard. So I wanted to be a part of that solution to turn things around, which is why I chose to be on the Board of Commissioners.
Yeah, thank you for that. The Housing Authority recently announced that it's partnering with the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, also called HUD, on the Milwaukee Recovery Plan. And that's coming after the Housing Authority illegally used $2.8 million in federal funding to pay for administrative costs under previous leadership. So what are the repercussions of that? And will any current or former Housing Authority leaders or board members be held accountable for that?
Well, I'm not quite sure of what the consequences are altogether. We are working closely with HUD. For us, the primary thing was, one, to discover it, to figure out what was happening. And as soon as it was discovered, Eddie, we shared that publicly. Now, it was as dismal as it was. We wanted to be as transparent as possible with everything that we're uncovering, because that's the only way that we can heal and move forward as a better organization, right? So we're working closely with HUD. As you know, we executed the agreement on January 31st, and we are working on a current sustainability plan. And I would say with the new agreement, it helps to strengthen that financial controls and quality control process. It enhanced tenant services and improved housing conditions, increasing the occupancy rates, as well as improving collection efforts and establishing clear timelines and reporting progress transparently. So we are focusing on how do we get out of this. Yes, I don't know how we got here. I can be honest with that, Eddie. It's it's bewildering for it to have carried on as long as it has, just to be discovered now under this new leadership. But we are committed to turning these things around to the best of our ability. And with our new board of commissioners, their passion and their commitment, their talents is, you know, married with or partnered with the changing of the executive team and leadership of Hackam, I strongly believe that we can certainly meet the new demands of HUD and create a sustaining organization that we can be proud of once again.
The Housing Authority has reduced its staff by 20 and instituted a hiring freeze for stability. What measures are being put in place to ensure the agency's future funding is allocated correctly and transparently while also tending to the needs of the residents?
Well, as you know, we had to take immediate action to ensure the agency's financial stability while minimizing any impact on the residents. Because one thing that we are is resident-focused, resident-centric. So, like you said, reducing staff by 20, instituting a hiring freeze. We are also realigning staff to meet the needs of the agency and better serve the residents, while eliminating non-essential expenditures. So a lot of these cost-cutting measures are not expected to impact the services for the residents because, once again, we don't want to be a part of that problem of marginalizing the residents.
Can you tell me about how the agency has changed overall recently and describe some of the new board members and why they were brought on?
Oh, wow. How we've changed. it is a new day. So with the new era of leadership and accountability, Housing Authority has restructured the board. And with the new leadership, we are committed to transparency, whereas before there was a great lack of transparency that was happening. The agency is now collaborating with HUD, the mayor's office, the city council office, as well as some of the community advocacy groups like Common Ground that really, you know, made waves for the residents. And we're working really closely with the resident organizations as well. So the residents, staff, and other stakeholders, we are really putting forth a great effort for everyone to be informed and engaged throughout the process. So this is more of a collaborative effort, Eddie, than I can have ever imagined with a public housing authority.
You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Eddie Morales, speaking with Charlotte Hazlett, chairwoman of the city's housing authority. What would you say are the most pressing issues to address when it comes to some of resident complaints or concerns regarding public safety, housing conditions, and maintenance?
Well, one, we want to make sure, I mean, that they have a comfortable place to call home. I mean, it doesn't matter what their level of payment is, they are paying for a service. And like with any landlord, we expect great services. So we're looking to make their houses back into homes where they are free from any pest infestations. They are free from a bunch of crime and things where they feel unsafe walking their neighborhoods. And I know crime is everywhere. Don't get me wrong. Crime is everywhere. But we want them to feel safe in their homes. We want them to be healthy in their homes. Eddie, these are our most vulnerable population. It's our elderly, our disabled members, children, our women. So we want to make sure that we are taking care of them and living up to our mission of providing great housing for everyone. So with that being said, some of the things that we are doing to incorporate the residents as we move forward, because again, it's important that they are a part of this process, because if it wasn't for them, Housing Authority wouldn't even exist. I wouldn't be here. So we've incorporated public listening sessions Every month at our Board of Commissioners meeting, where they can come in and address us with their concerns, comments, or whatever it is that they have that they would like to share with the Board of Commissioners. We have the quarterly listening sessions at the Housing Authority Developments, which will begin on February 26th at Beecher Court in the afternoon. And we're inviting all residents to come out and to be heard, and we can have that platform for them. And again, restoring that power back to the resident organizations that are housed within every development, and ongoing dialogue with those resident organizations will continue, as well as additional opportunities for resident engagements to be explored. So there are some subcommittees that we are working on right now, like ad hoc committees of our Board of Commissions, that we would like to have residents represented around the table as well. So we are creating platforms for them to be even closer with the Board of Commission, to be heard, as well as be incorporated into the new era of sufficiencies and stability and just greatness overall for the Housing Authority.
Does the Housing Authority look at other agencies in the region or in the country as a reference to what works and doesn't work? I'm just curious about that.
That was one of the things that the Board of Commissioners placed upon the executive team, is to look across the country. We're even working with HUD. What's going well? What isn't going well? What can we implement or emulate, you know, right away, or model ourselves after? So we don't want to reinvent the wheel. If there's someone out there that's already doing the work and they're doing it well, and it's things that we can incorporate into what we are trying to achieve, going back to a high performing public housing authority, then yes, because it's not a one size fit all, Eddie. You know, you have some housing authorities that have a great maintenance crew. What are you doing? And then there's someone who has a model, you know, finance department that really has its model, it's a standard, or it's exceeding standards. Those are the housing authorities that we are looking to partner with and to work with. And our team is already a step ahead by identifying who and what those housing authorities are and where they are in the country and how we can collaborate.
What do you hope the agency is able to accomplish in 2025?
I have such ambitious plans, Eddie. I'm hoping ultimately to rebuild the trust with our residents and other stakeholders, because we've dropped the ball and there's a compromise, you know, that well, I wouldn't say a compromise, but there are some things that has contributed to the mistrust. So I'm hoping to rebuild trust and strengthen our operations by, one, communicating, over-communicating with our stakeholders and being brutally transparent, where, yes, a lot of this stuff is embarrassing to uncover, but this is where we are. And I'm not in the business of hiding anything, covering anything. The only way we can overcome a lot of the mismanagement is to be transparent, because it equates to accountability. Another thing that I would like to see is for 2025 is the commitment to long-term success. You know, forging a rock-solid plan that sustains us well beyond the 10-year mark, that meets the needs of the residents as well as the community.
Charlotte Hazlett is the chair of the Board of Commissioners for the Housing Authority of the City of Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. Wisconsin winters are warming. This trend is just one element of climate change that we're seeing and feeling. Next week, WUWM is airing a series of stories exploring some of the facets of what scientists are studying, what ecosystems are experiencing, and what we're navigating as humans. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz is here with me to talk about the upcoming series. It's called Thin Ice 2025, Our Warming Winters. Susan, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Audrey.
So this series, I'm sure, has so many subjects, there's so many elements, and I imagine it took you all across the state, hey?
I did do a little traveling. It was really great to meet with people who are involved in projects and really want to make a difference and are tuned into this climate that is changing. So one of my first stops was to meet Liz Griffith. She has an orchard east of Madison. She cultivates about 90 varieties as naturally as she possibly can, and she was in the process of pruning when I visited, a big job every winter. She says the ups and downs of this winter temperatures, not just this winter, but over recent years, are really tough on her trees.
In the fall, when things start cooling down, they gain dormancy, right? And they hit their peak dormancy when it gets the coldest, right? And they're able to handle it. If then you have a stretch of milder weather, they'll start to lose dormancy. And then if it drops back down again real abruptly, that's when you get tissue damage on the tree, roots, buds, things like that, because it's just not as dormant, it's not as hardy. So that's a big issue.
So we just got a little scene from an orchard, but you also explored the impacts to not just our plant life, but wildlife.
That's right. I made one stop in Waukesha. That's where their team of park workers and volunteers are working on restoration. They're seeing impacts there as well. And then at Mequon Nature Preserve, where Ecological Restoration Manager Nick Gall and Biodiversity Program Director Gary Casper shared their work. They actually have a 100-year plan, which they're 25 years into, and they're seeing, just in recent years, the warming winters impacting their work in the field.
Star-nosed moles and other small mammals that are like in this prairie, those species are really affected by these poor winter conditions we're having right now with no snow on the ground, because that snow, it's an insulating layer. So the little voles that are feeding on grasses and seeds, they can forage all winter under the snow and they're protected from predators. But when it's this cold, they're exposed to predation if they're on the surface feeding. Plus, if there's a deep freeze, it can reach their underground retreats and they may not survive. And that's true for some of the amphibians here as well. So these snowless winters are becoming an issue, and we need to keep tabs on how that's affecting the critters.
So then next week on Lake Effect, Audrey, two UW-Madison researchers will share what they're learning about the impacts of reduced snow cover. And one of the species they're studying is the snowshoe hare in Wisconsin.
So we just had a little preview of the effects it's having on mammals, but you also took a look at Lake Michigan fisheries.
That's right. We take a closer look at whitefish. And the reason we're doing that is that it's the foundation of the state's commercial fishery. And in recent years, sports fishermen have gravitated to fishing the species through the ice. So last year, 2024, the ice cover was scarce. This year, I met one of the people whose livelihood depends on good ice. That's Zach Burgess. He runs a fishing guide business in Door County. Just a month ago, he still hadn't been able to get the fish shanties his customers use out onto the bay.
People might see me drive my UTV out there today, and there's spots that I might be 10 feet away from open water. Well, if that skims over and you don't realize, and they see me out past it, and they just start driving, and they drop through, so I try warning people, yes, you can if you walk your route first. I walk all my paths. Last night, I put on about 2 miles walking with a chisel. I will be walking many more miles yet this year.
From ice fishing as a livelihood, it's also a massive source of recreation here in Wisconsin, and winter recreation is historically vital to our local economy. For example, there's the Birkebeiner that's coming up next week in the Cable Hayward area, and of course, there's snowmobilers and downhill ski operators that, of course, count on snowy conditions in order to do the sports.
Absolutely, and then there's the ice boating scene. I caught up with a regatta on Lake Winnebago. That was in January. The sailors had to search around for a lake that was safe, that had good ice cover so that they could hold that event. Ice sailors from Michigan, Illinois, as far away as Pennsylvania congregated around their love of the sport. And I talked to the youngest enthusiast in the group. Maggie McGarry is a high school freshman who traveled from Minneapolis with her coach.
I think it's just you're 6 inches off the ice going 40, 50 miles an hour. That feels a lot faster, especially when you don't have a windshield like in a car. There's so much wind and there's so much speed that you're kind of like, oh my gosh. It's a very like precarious feeling almost. Don't steer too fast. Don't change anything.
So, Audrey, from ice boating on Lake Winnebago, we head west of Milwaukee to hear about an Oconomowoc watershed partnership. Again, water being the theme. The goal of this group is to reduce runoff that impacts the health of the waters they share. And then here in the city, Jerome Flogel will be sharing his insights on the challenges of warming winters. He heads Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District efforts. They're working to control flooding and improve water quality in Milwaukee's 30th Street corridor.
We have to be prepared to manage stormwater pretty much 12 months out of the year, because we can get an event, you know, like we've seen the last, let's say, month, where we have these swings in temperature and it gets to 50 degrees. And we have an inch of rain, we have to be ready to manage that, not only in the sanitary, but in the storm. And then it just makes it worse if we've gone through a cold period and we have frozen ground and we have zero permeability pretty much, and it's all going to be runoff.
Now, while you are, of course, our esteemed environmental reporter, this topic is pretty massive for just you to take on all by yourself. So are there other collaborators fueling the series and helping you out?
Absolutely. This time around, our colleague Chuck Kornbach will be sharing timely reports, including on the status of federally funded EV charging stations and their future under the Trump administration. And then there's the tug and pull around plans to meet the power demands of high-tech industries.
Big topic. Lots of traveling around. It sounds like quite the tour.
Yeah, it'll be good.
Well, thank you for giving us a taste of our 2025 Thin Ice series coming up. It'll be next week here on Lake Effect and also during Morning Edition on Milwaukee's NPR. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen to us on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll share some love songs loved by WUWM staff. But first, we'll speak with Milwaukee Film's new executive director, Susan Kearns. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As of February 3rd, Dr. Susan Kearns is the new executive director of Milwaukee Film. The appointment follows Ann Reed's interim term last year, which was one of major transition and tumult, both financially and restructuring after several recent challenges. Milwaukee Film made cuts to educational programs and artist services and eliminated the Cultures and Communities Festival, to name a few of the changes. Kearns joins me now to share what her goals and priorities are 1 week into the new position, and she begins by explaining her lifelong passion for film.
My background in film goes, I think, way back, actually. When I was a kid, I wanted to be an actor.
Okay.
And I grew up in Iowa. Weirdly, there were films being made in Iowa when I was a kid, like the movie Country with Jessica Lange and Sam Shepard. I auditioned for that.
Wow, okay.
Did not get it.
But yeah, that small connection.
Yeah, but there was something about feeling like the world of movies was accessible through acting. So that's really where I started. When I was in college, I started as an acting major and auditioned for some plays. I was in some friends' films and some local commercials and things. But truthfully, I just wasn't very good. And I think it was helpful for me to learn that early.
Sure. To know that your passion could be redirected in some sort of way.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I did really still want to work in film. So everybody had sort of told me that I was a good writer my whole life. And I was like, well, maybe that's what I do. Maybe I write about movies. So I moved into being a journalism major and then really with this focus of writing about film. At the time, I was like addicted to Entertainment Weekly. Like every Friday, I sat on my couch with it for an hour and like read it cover to cover. I started working with the South by Southwest Film Festival when it was very young, when I was a college kid, just like volunteering for it and being active. And so that's when I really got the festival bug, too. So I've carried those things with me as I got my master's degree, as I got my PhD.
Which you studied here.
Yeah. Correct. Mm-hmm. Yep. At UWM. And I was always sort of doing English and film at the same time, which has really afforded me just these excellent opportunities. One of the great things about Milwaukee is that when you're working in film here as like a film scholar, people also want you to be involved with their film productions. And so I met Tate Bunker at the time, and he was like, hey, I'm working on this project. Do you want to, you know, help me write it? And I was like, yeah, please let me in. And I just kept finding people that I really liked personally and wanted to work on projects with. And that's how Man Life came about. And I just feel so lucky that Milwaukee is open to people saying, like, I listened to a podcast with Dan Harmon, who wrote Community and Rick and Morty, and he lives in L.A. now. He's incredibly successful from Milwaukee. And he said one of the great things about Milwaukee is that when you live in Milwaukee, you can tell people, hey, I'm a writer, and they believe you, and they give you opportunities. Yeah. And I feel that reflected in my own career, and again, feel just really lucky that I was able to cultivate that in the city.
Yeah, and your role as executive director is kind of a full circle homecoming moment in a way. As we mentioned, you studied, you got your doctorate from UWM, and as a film student, you volunteered with the Milwaukee International Film Festival, which later became Milwaukee Film Festival. And you also served as Milwaukee Film's education director from 2011 to 2013. So you touched upon this a bit about the overall community here in Milwaukee. But what about the community around the organization stands out to you and has kept you involved over the years?
Well, I think, again, the people. Kara Ogburn has obviously done incredible things with the programming and trying to make sure that the organization is really alive at a national level. So people all over the country know who Milwaukee Film is, what Milwaukee Film is, in large part because of the outreach efforts that she has been doing kind of behind the scenes for the better part of a decade or over a decade, really. So that has been really helpful. The fact that I have been based in Chicago, I have been, you know, working there with the film organizations in that city, but still connected to Milwaukee, been able to do some things like there was a master class with Agnieszka Holland, the incredible Polish filmmaker, hero, icon, a year maybe before the pandemic hit. And Kara, because she and I knew each other from grad school, she invited me to, you know, to essentially do that masterclass or facilitate that masterclass with Agnieszka Holland. And so things like that, I've been very lucky that they've kept me tapped in and I've wanted to tap in when they ask me. Also, the members at Milwaukee Film are incredible. And so every year when I go to the film festival, I see people that I knew when I was the education director, worked, you know, on screenings with them or at theaters with them. And the fact that it's such a community that has been coming together and talking about film and helping the organization succeed. For as much as the staff feels like a family, the members feel like a family too.
Yeah. So I think you're in a unique position to be someone who has such knowledge of what it takes to make a film long before we see it at a local theater here. So what strengths do you believe you have as a filmmaker that can apply to your leadership role here as a leader of a nonprofit?
Well, I think nonprofits need to be a little bit scrappy. And certainly independent filmmaking is all about being scrappy. So I do think that there are some instincts there that will help me in this role. We want to be doing everything at a high level at Milwaukee Film. Again, we're, you know, we know that when people come in from New York, when people come in from LA, we want them to be impressed by Milwaukee Film. We are not sacrificing any kind of quality, but sometimes you have to pull a few strings behind the scenes to get that to happen. And again, that is all of independent filmmaking. Like, nobody in independent filmmaking has everything go exactly how they plan or how they want
infinite
it.
Infinite resources.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it's really like, okay, what are we doing right now? How can we get this done, you know, the best that we can with the resources we have and put something out to the world that we're all really, really proud of?
Speaking of wanting to put your best foot forward, all that good stuff, you know, that does come with growing pains. And it's no secret that Milwaukee Film has been in the midst of financial and organizational changes that you are inheriting, so to speak. This includes some staff and programming cuts, and that included the Cultures and Communities Festival. That was a particularly big announcement. And also education and artist services programs to give listeners just a general picture. So did this position that the organization is in, I'm sure it wasn't news to you, having you know, been involved and following it over the years, but did it give you pause at all in going for the job?
It did and it didn't. Certainly, I wanted to be very informed about all of those changes. I asked a lot of questions about, you know, what is the economic situation of the organization? I know a lot of the people who, you know, had worked for the organization. I'm still friends with many of them. So I know a lot of that very intimately. At the same time, there's something very exciting about a fresh start. And that's something that I hope that I can bring with me. You know, we know that there are skeletons in the closet. We know that we don't have all the money in the world right now. I'm hoping that we get to a point where we do. But reimagining sort of how we can use cinema to engage the community and how we can affect change through cinema, through film, through understanding both cinematic history and, like you had mentioned earlier, that there's a real... It seems like there's a real feeling that people want to know more about the art form. And that's exactly what I teach at the college level. So I want to dive into that with people and figure out how to do that more while also, you know, making sure that we engage all kinds of members of the community, whether it's audiences and filmmakers. And certainly with the film festival, we have a really large local presence or presence of local filmmakers within the Cream City Cinema film selections for the festival. All of that is trying to support the community of makers here. And so bolstering, you know, those connections too.
Given what we just talked about, you mentioned, yes, there's a fresh start, but, you know, sometimes in an outside perspective, there's also like ground to make up given these changes. So outside of some of the things you just listed, what are your main priorities? Like, what are you triaging, so to speak? And, you know, it's only been a weekend, so I know, like, there's work to be done. But in your perspective, what are you like, here's my main areas of focus that I want to concentrate on, at least in this first year or
so? Well, right now, all eyes are on the film festival. The film festival is April 24th through May 8th. And that's really where the focus is. I'm very much coming into, you know, sort of I'm sort of jumping into the middle of the tornado. It seems early, but it actually isn't.
Right. So, a lot of groundwork has already been laid out since last year's wrapped up. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. So so people are asking me, like, what are you doing right now? Right now, I am riding that wave.
<You know>? Understandable. Yeah.
But after that, then what I want to do is really make a strategic plan with the folks who are at Milwaukee Film currently, the programming team, the marketing team. I think there's a lot more that we can do, really connecting with local community organizations, bringing in people, doing some programming that pushes boundaries a little bit differently, obviously continuing to, you know, show the things that everybody also wants to see. But I think, you know, we do want to do some riskier programming. We also, again, really want to make sure that the community knows that these are the people's cinemas. And so working with organizations to bring events into the cinemas, doing some more kind of, you know, eventizing of even film screenings and bringing not just the fun of movies into it, but also the, you know, the depth of cinema history, building that into some of our programming, and again, also this community action element.
Yeah, and part of the challenge with anything, you know, public radio included, is trying to bring in audiences that aren't familiar, that aren't gonna go to the film site right away, go to the dial to find us, anything like that. And the recent cuts of Milwaukee Film has raised concerns among former partners, the community, about where that leaves programming and events that, as you know, the communities you've worked with uplift younger, more diverse voices, filmmakers in the community, and also how the organization's commitment to racial justice looks like behind the scenes. As you mentioned, you know some people who were with Milwaukee Film are no longer with the organization. So with your unique position, having connections with the community and connections to be fostered, what gaps do you see and want to close in on when it relates to diverse audiences and films and partnering with other local organizations that can help you do that?
Yeah, I think I want to be very strategic about audience outreach and what kind of programming we have throughout the year. We know that we do a very good job during the film festival of like representing different voices, representing different cultures, representing different countries, you know, and we have sort of these blocks of programming here and there. I want to make sure that it's really well-rounded throughout the year so that it really doesn't ever feel like an add-on. It can feel like a focus from time to time, but I don't want it to feel like an add-on. And I know that I have some repair work to do. I plan to be very out and about in the community. I plan to be very present, making sure that I can build these personal connections with, you know, with companies, with corporations, with groups, to make sure that, you know, they start to know me, because I do feel like the personal is political, and that if I can have good relationships with folks, I think we'll start to earn back some of that trust.
Well, Susan, good luck as you continue. We're week one in and more to come, but thank you so much for joining me today, and I look forward to having you back in the near future.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Audrey, and I look forward to seeing you at the theaters.
I'll be there for sure. Susan Kearns is the new executive director of Milwaukee Film. There's more to our conversation, including the organization's intent for the Downer Theater, and you can listen to all of that at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and when we get back, get ready to fall in love. We'll share some love songs ahead of Valentine's Day picked by WUWM staff. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For Valentine's Day this year, we asked WUWM staff to share the love songs that pull at their heartstrings, bring back memories, and just make them feel good. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez brings you that mixtape.
Hi, my name is Excret Nunez, and I'm a producer for Lake Effect. And one of my favorite love songs is Forever by Charlie XCX. Forever is off my favorite Charlie XCX album called How I'm Feeling Now, which she completely produced in about a month during the COVID lockdown. And my partner and I had been dating for about 6 months when this song came out, but we were dating long distance at the time. And so this was one of the first songs we dedicated to each other and that we ended up playing often on our radio show together when we were DJs in college. So this song makes me feel really nostalgic about my first love. And I love how we've adapted this song to feel like it's our own, and we still love jamming out to it whenever it comes on. So yeah, I hope you enjoy hearing the favorite love songs of my friends and colleagues at WUWM. This was really fun to produce.
My name is Lori Jones. I am the host of Here and Now and the operations director here at WUWM. And my favorite love song is So Amazing by Luther Vandross. Not even one sad day or minute have I had since you've come my way. I hope you know I gladly go. But Luther is the master of the love song, number one, so I could have picked many from him. But the reason I like this one is his vocal is so pure on it. He can do runs, he can do all kinds of, you know, vocal acrobatics. But the way he sings this song is really pure. And it's not really even so much about the words, but every time I hear this song, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but like a single tear will run down my face. And I don't even realize it's happening until it happens. So there's just something about the song that hits me really deep inside every time I hear it. And that's why it's my favorite. I would leave you never and never. Guess we've got amazing love. Ooh, so
hi, my name is Erin Bagata, and I am WUWM's Community Engagement and Audience Development Coordinator. And my love song of choice, I'm not saying favorite because I'm really bad at picking favorites, but my love song of choice is How Can You Live If You Can't Love? How Can You If You Do? By Wednesday. The title of this song is actually pulled from a quote from James Baldwin's novel, Another Country. And the song speaks on the paradox of love and how it both sustains us and makes us so happy, but also challenges us. And I like that because love isn't always cliche and grandiose and so perfect and pure and nice. Love is imperfect and it does challenge us. And I like this song because the lyrics feel very everyday to me. Even the way that the singer sings, like nothing is showy. It seems very authentic and real. And that's why I like it.
My name is Audrey Nowakowski. I'm a co-host and a producer of Lake Effect here at WWM. And my song for today is called Secret Love by Doris Day from the movie Calamity Jane, which was released in 1953.
Became impatient to be free. So I told a friendly star.
So the song is, of course, the big number, the like peak of this character's arc. It's post her glow up when she has this big realization and all that stuff. And not only is Doris Day just an amazing singer to begin with, so that stands out because she just does such a great job, but the song itself has so many things that happen after the film. So it really cemented Doris Day as a gay icon because at the time the film was released, most people kept their crushes secret, and this song became an anthem for the LGBTQ community after this came out. The song also sold a million copies. It reached number one on the Billboard chart. It also won the 1954 Oscar for Best Original Song, and it was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1999. So I first saw this film on a whim. My friend and I made a little tradition of renting random movie musicals from the library and literally picking it by the cover, even though you say you can't judge it, but I'm so glad we picked it by a good cover. And we just became obsessed with the movie. And we're like, why is this so good? And it just was like a nice light time in such a weird, uncertain time because it was during COVID. So, you know, you were picking who you spent time with very carefully. And it was just a nice respite from everything else that was happening in the world. And for me, it's like the love of friendship that you can experience. And this song for me is connected to that. And it kind of went into my personal hall of fame, aka Spotify Wrapped, because it had, and I say this because my friend also had it pop up in his, and we watched this like later in the winter. So in a very short amount of time, it was in our Wrapped, and it said I played it 65 times with the most listens on January 29th, which is probably the day after we watched this film together. So I just think so fondly of watching this film with my friend and just being blown away by it. And Doris is such a great singer, so anytime I need a boost, just cue up Secret Love.
At last, my heart's an open door. Your smile, your voice, creeps inside my heart with everything you do. I have no choice.
My name is Rob Larry. I am a digital producer and the host of All Things Considered here at WUWM. And the song that I've chosen today is called I Choose You by Kiana Lene.
You would hold me together even though I was your baby. You would start the fight in me. One that was there to hold my back. Don't you know that I choose you?
So there is a pure nostalgia aspect to it. My wife actually showed it to me, and it was a song that we use in our wedding ceremony and something that we use in our wedding video. And when we were going through the process of, you know, that whole process of planning the wedding and going through all those things, as soon as I hear it, it just sends me back to a really magical time in our lives. And so that's one of the reasons. Aside from just the pure nostalgia, another thing that I like about it is I really resonate with just the central message of the song. I think that love is certainly an emotion, and it's an experience, and it's a feeling. I think there's a lot of power in that. But also, I do fundamentally believe that love ultimately is a choice. When we talk about the love that endures, you know, all things and conquers all and is, you know, the most powerful force in existence, you have to make a conscious decision to continue to love yourself, to continue to love your partner, to continue to love the people around you, your family. And so, yeah, that's one of the reasons why it really speaks to me.
Ayan Silver. I am a general assignment reporter with the WUWM Newsroom, and my song that I'm choosing for favorite love song is Cruisin' by D'Angelo. It's a cover. Okay, so seriously, the harmonies in that section that you just heard, it literally makes me melt. Like, just D'Angelo's voice, the falsettos that he can get to, somebody harmonizing with him, and then the little, like, super slick piano chord at the end. It's so smooth. It's so sexy. It's just, like, an amazing song. I kind of rediscovered it just this past year and played it probably more than 100 or 200 times during the election season. I mean, I love the lines like, I love it when we're cruising together. The music is played for love. Cruising is made for love, et cetera, et cetera. And interestingly, Smokey Robinson, the Motown great, did the original version of this song. It was written in 1979, and in the book Chicken Soup for the Soul, the story behind the song, he was asked what cruising means to him, and his answer is always the same, whatever you want it to be. And I totally love that, because you can just groove out to this song. It doesn't have to be about love or romantic love, but it can be. It can be really whatever you want, and the lyrics just hit you. They make you melt.
That playlist of WUWM favorite love songs wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Jimmy Gutierrez, Eddie Morales, and Susan Bentz from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for the start of our Thin Ice series, which explores the impact of Wisconsin's warming winters on different industries in the state. Plus, we'll learn about the work a Wisconsin native is doing in D.C. at the White House Historical Association. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. If you want it, you got it.